The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
Hello to you, I'm Ben McKechin.
G'day, I'm Mark Hadley, and welcome to The Big Picture for Monday, June 8th. Coming up on today's show,
we welcome back our Nicole Kidman. She's back on our big screen. She's returning to the terrifying unknowns of the Australian outback.
And speaking of terror, not our Nick, we hear of a TV researcher's clues on how not to get caught out at parties when the conversation turns to Australian film.
Conversation, sure. And I'm going to share with you my top five time to make a stand films where you are guaranteed to feel absolutely motivated about something, Mark. That's coming up on today's show.
And I'll learn how to type.
Nice to see you, friends.
It's good to be here.
You can tell it's wintry because I'm wearing a beanie and a t-shirt. That's how crazy for winter I am.
I can't believe you guys. You next generation knew.
Next generation guy with a beard and a beanie and a t-shirt. Let's move right on to the first segment, Mark. Now showing, we're going to focus on a locally produced but shameless ripoff of an American idea. Now, it's one that nonetheless seems to work for Australian audiences. Now, comedian, actress, former rock quiz host and Eurovision Song Contest commentator Julia Zemiro has given us a guided tour of Australian comedy. She started doing that in 2013 on our small screens when she launched the series Julia Zemiro's Home Delivery. She couldn't think of something else, just put a name up there, Julia Zemiro's Home Delivery. The first two series, they featured laughable Australians like Carl Barron and Wendy Harmer, Dave Hughes, all touring about in a vintage car powering around the suburbs, driving down memory lane. And that series is back.
Oh, hello. I'm Julia. I'm your driver. It was the Jesuits that famously said, "Give me that child until he's seven and I will give you the man." Over the next 5 weeks, I'll be hitting the road.
Does this car now look like a meat-filled Jaffa?
Taking some of my favourite funny people back to their childhoods.
Should we go and have a look in the classroom?
Scary, scary.
So many of my memories were made here.
To uncover the forces that shape them.
I was away from home and I hated it.
Now, do you mind coming on this little adventure with us?
If I get to talk about myself, who doesn't like to talk about themselves?
Well, this is season three of Julia Zemiro's Home Delivery, and this is the one where they take a major departure. So up to this date, they've basically been doing Australian comedians, you know, funny people in Australia, take them out for a drive, get a bit of a giggle, find out where they come from at the same time, you know, and their background, why they are funny people, that sort of thing. But now we're actually going on to sort of, they've done the international trip. But it's really kind of the budget international trip because they basically...
So the season three is the budget.
Season three,
trip.
They've sprung for a couple of tickets, you know, for the cameraman and Julia to go to London. And the cars are now all hire cars, quite clearly hire cars. So they're not really, you know, much of an interest in the show. But look, they start off, you know, with a mixture of some homegrown Australian talent and then some sort of international people, i.e., you know, English funny people. And so first up last week was Ian Thorpe. And this Wednesday...
As in the swimmer Ian Thorpe.
And like I'm
what's
saying,
happened to the comedian
I know,
idea?
That's what I'm trying to say. There was nothing funny about his life at all. I was waiting for the moment we were going to giggle, but actually it was kind of like a bit of a hug fest. Anyway, and so Julia takes us through, you know, around his sort of stomping grounds. Not so much where he grew up as the pools that he learned to swim in. Here's another pool which I swam in. This is a gym that I worked out in.
I weed in this one.
And you can still... Anyway.
This bit's warm, sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, and this Wednesday, though, then they sort of flip onto the first of the international program. So Matt Lucas, British comedian Matt Lucas from, you know, Little Britain, he's taking you around his town, so to speak, and where he grew up. And then we come back to Australia and we do Lee Sales, the well-known host of 7:30 Report. You know what I'm saying?
I'm laughing already. What do you think about this format? Overall, though, I'm not sure whether it's sounding like you're liking this series or not, but what about the format also? Do you like it?
Well, look, the format is good if only because it was ripped off. Okay, so the format is almost a complete parody of Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars with Coffee.
Yeah.
And so basically, they just get two people with a range of cameras around them and drive around. Now, in Seinfeld's version, the cars are always amazing. Like there's this classic, you know, Dodge or this is amazing Ferrari or something like that. They tried to match the car something to the personality of the person. None of that. Okay, in this, we didn't have the money to hire anything, it seems. So that's okay. I mean, I don't want to hit them up for that. But then also, Seinfeld's version is funny.
Ooh.
And, okay, so they've transitioned.
But were the first two series funny?
Yes, well, they were. That's the thing. So Julie Samira was funny. Now they seem to have driven, to follow the metaphor, off the road into Australian Story territory.
Yeah, okay. You know? And so but we already have Australian Story. It's been going a long time and doing quite well.
Exactly. So, look, I think it's interesting. I think it's fun. But I would have watched any interview about Ian Thorpe and his life growing up. I'm not sure this format or Julia Zemiro really sort of gives us anything. So that's kind of strange. But you're going to judge it, I think, episode by episode. You know, it is that biographic stuff that we're kind of familiar with, yeah.
Yeah, there's been plenty of TV shows that have been around this idea of where people have come from, going back into their past, showing what it means for them now. Why do you think this concept, why do you think it's still going, but also why do you think audiences really go after it? Because people do like programs like
that's
this.
That's the weird thing. I think the third season is around as a testimony to the fact that people do like
Yeah, yeah, they've
know,
been
biopics.
Very popular. Yeah, yeah. People are searching into their ancestry and doing family trees seems to have become massive in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, exactly at the point which my father-in-law decided to get into it. It's just huge. I think it's driven the entire industry. Look, I think we feel rightly that there is something about our past that explains our present. You know, so that's the basic core, that we want to actually be known and we want to sometimes offer an explanation for our lives. You know, I'm like this because, you know, you sit around with people and people are often dredging up their past in the context of a conversation to say, this is why I'm like this or this is why I do that or that sort of thing. You know, our past explains us. And so if we want to understand some of these great celebrities, it's no big surprise that we want to know about their past. You know, we want to know when Ian Thorpe suddenly decided he was going to be a swimmer. Did he really want it? Was he thrown in the pool by mum and dad and forced to go down at 4 a.m. every morning? Or was he a nipper who just couldn't wait? You know, so I feel like when we look at these programs, we're admitting that there is a big issue with our past. The interesting thing about Julia Zemiro's home delivery, though, is that there's just as much to regret back there as there is to admire or even to understand.
And is there much admission of regret?
Yeah, there is. There's a fair number of times in the series so far and in this current series in which people talk about stuff they'd actually like to leave behind, schools they wish they'd burnt down as opposed to have attended. You know, and so there's a lot about the past that hangs on us and we don't know what to do with it. We talk about it, we share it, but there's a lot more that is just there. And in fact, you'll see in some of the issues, some of the programs, people just get a bit shaky going back to look at these things because we've left the past behind, but it's often undealt with. From a Christian perspective, that's like, what am I going to do with this? You know, is a very common, not just Australian, but a human feeling. What am I going to do with my past? And all of us have bits, years even sometimes, that we just want to write off and forget. But that doesn't mean we dealt with them. And I feel like it's this angst that's at the heart of these biopic things, as much the bitter as the sweet. Mm. And so from a Christian perspective, I look at this and I go, I actually have a bit of a relief when I watch this program, because sometimes you look at these people, these great celebrities, and they're going nowhere with it. They're just going, I have pushed on my personality, my jokes, they're carrying me, that's what I'm doing. Whereas I can actually at least say, you know, the past is dealt with. I don't, somebody could bring it up and I could say, yeah, but that's not me. And I've been taken care of. That's what God's done for me. And in a very personal, human and sort of day-to-day way, that's a kind of a powerful thing. So I feel like people look at these programs for an explanation of why we are the way we are, hoping to explain and maybe even looking as to how people got over some of those things, because we all want to get over, you know, our past to some degree. I'm fascinated by me. I think I'll just move on to something else.
Mate, I am too. I was enthralled. What are we going to talk about next, Mark?
Well, now we're going to move into sort of strange territory, if you like. thanks for the pun, Mark. Nicole Kidman hasn't made a small independent film in her homeland since Dead Calm in 1989, but the Oscar winner returned to such territory for Strangerland. This is co-starring Hugo Weaving and Shakespeare in Love's leading man, Joseph Fiennes. Probably hasn't done anything terribly good since.
He hasn't really. I haven't seen him for some time.
When he blipped up on the screen with this one, I was like, oh, you're back. What's Ray doing? That's Ray. Sorry, yeah. Anyway, so Strangerland is a disturbing drama about a family in remote New South Wales town rocked by tragic events.
Lily's gone. She's out there somewhere.
Hi, Birdie.
Would you put some clothes on, please?
Lily's been missing before.
Hello?
Your daughter's a whore.
I reckon that girl's a goner.
I have to tell you something.
Why did you go out in the middle of the night?
Why are you doing this?
Because you're not doing anything!
Stop it.
Mark, I think that clip gave some indication of what Strangerland's like. Strangerland's now at cinemas playing around the place.
And if it didn't, the music did.
And if it was, yeah, that's
this
right.
This is foreboding. You should know.
But Nicole Kidman's playing Catherine. Joseph Fiennes playing Matthew. They're married. As you said, they've recently moved to an outback town. As that clip demonstrated, the kids have gone missing. And what Strangerland becomes is like a little bit of a kaleidoscope. It becomes this eerie tapestry of what happens in the aftermath of trauma and the effect not just on this married couple, but on their and their relationship, but also relationships of those around them as well. It's a very eerie film, really quite evocative at times. I found for the first half particularly, I was really engrossed, and then increasingly,
and then you ran out of
tape
Tim
it off a little bit. No, not so much. It becomes a bit repetitive. There's some really great outback imagery, some great mystery, and a lot of red herrings and different subplots that it goes off in a lot of different directions. But the repetition comes because it keeps coming back to different ideas, but not necessarily going through with them. And some of that makes sense. You're not always going to have resolution, you know, particularly when it comes to loss and missing children. But one of the things I really liked about it is this focus on the many different sides of tragedy. The other thing I didn't like about it, though, is that there's too much focus. It spreads it very thin. And by the end, it gets to some really...
Do you mean this is like it's plot chopping and changing all the
time? Yeah,
it
just feels like it goes off in so many different directions. It's by spreading itself too thin and its focus too thin, it becomes a little bit unsatisfying by the time you reach some conclusions, which are quite powerful in themselves. But maybe there's just too many things going on at once.
Somebody should have made a film, you know, like 20 minutes shorter or something like that.
Maybe. Or maybe just reined in a little bit or just not gone off in so many different directions as deeply as they did. And then sometimes the ones you wish they'd followed, they didn't quite. But the performances are great, particularly Nicole Kidman's this fragile, brittle wife. One of the real resounding things for me is that how it leaves you thinking about the consequences of tragedy for the people left behind afterwards, which, you know, kids go missing every day of the week, which is terrible, but what happens to those people that are left behind, the impact on their family?
Is this Evil Angels all over again? I mean, like,
sounds a bit, doesn't it?
You've got couple, child goes missing in the mysterious Australian outback, a little bit foreboding about that, what's going on. Is that what we're getting at?
For anyone who doesn't know, Evil Angels was that film in the 80s that Meryl Streep starred in.
Sorry, a bit of an insider club here. Evil Angels.
And Meryl's
film reviewer.
Meryl Streep starred as Lindy Chamberlain, one of the most famous, if not the most famous, case of a missing child in Australia. There have been other movies set in the outback about missing kids, including a great movie called Walkabout. A Picnic Hanging Rock also deals with very sort of similar subject matter. Yeah, I think the Australian outback is this place that represents for a lot of people insecurity and fear of the unknown and this great vast expanse that we have almost in our backyard that we're really quite proud of as Australians. We love like the look and the feel of it. At the same time as this is like this ominous thing.
We're equally terrified.
We're equally terrified by what's going on out there.
It's like that, you know, perverse but, you know, quite impressive aunt.
That's how I describe the outback, Mark. Yes.
Yes. Everybody likes to refer to her, but the idea of having her too close is always a bit of a scary thing.
It is well used in Strangeland, and there's some great, great, great location shots in this. It looks a little bit like a Come Visit New South Wales ad at different points, but the mystery of what is going on out there, what could possibly be going on out there, is well harnessed in Strangeland.
Yeah, I just want to delve into this outback idea just for a second because, like, we make jokes, but the truth is we even have phrases in our whole language, you know, that talk about how we are just uncomfortable about our continent. So the coastal cringe is what we refer to. Us all, you know, most of the population of Australia hugs a certain sort of span of kilometres right next to the coast. And it's not just because of the weather. So you have a sort of sense of, at least for white Australia, that we don't really trust anything, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's what the issue is. We don't trust it. It's a lack of control. It's just, and I think some of it is also just distance and the tyranny of that. You just don't want to be that far away from where things are. But I'd say largely we're freaked out by the outback because it's this wild, uncontrolled place that who knows what could happen out there.
Yeah, Razorback, for a start.
For example. That's right, Mad Max.
Max, there you go. Okay, that's what's happening now past Dubbo. Be careful. But look, let's get back to the relationship side. Is this a film about the struggle the struggle between husband and wife in a difficult
situation? Yeah, very
much
so. Very much so. One of the most powerful things about Strangeland, I think, is the depiction of the marriage between Catherine and Matthew and what the issue, if I can use such a polite word for their kids going missing, but what this issue, what this catalyst causes is it dredges up a lot of things that are already going on in their relationship and in their family. So these things that have been happening in the past, which you start hearing about more and more. The reason they've come to this town, there's a sex scandal involving their family that they're trying to run from. There's some really quite confronting and graphic moments in Strangeland about that past. But what I found even harder to take, and a lot of viewers will find that difficult, including a scene where Nicole Kidman walks down the street naked, because she's more like a graphic demonstration of the impact of tragedy and trauma on her rather than anything else. I don't think it's exploitative.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But it's very difficult to take. But what's harder to take, I think, is watching this marriage further crumble. They've had these issues in the past, but because they haven't attempted to work on them in the past and they've just gone on and on and on, it really, Strangeland shows you what can happen to a relationship impacted by trauma that doesn't have a strong foundation beneath it. And the answer is it just further corrodes.
Yeah, and I was going to say, does that highlight that in the film, the importance of maybe a stable relationship to handle a crisis?
It doesn't highlight it, but for me, that's one of the overwhelming things coming from the film. I was during the film and afterwards really quite impacted by thinking about the idea of you don't want trauma to happen in your life. No one wants a tragedy to happen, but we know it's just going to at some point. Things are going to happen in life that you're not going to be happy with, that are going to be sad, depressing, all kinds of things. Strangeland, this relationship with Catherine and Matthew, to me really pointed to how if you don't work on things before the tragedy strikes, man, it's going to go even worse for you, I think, when the tragedy does happen. There's teachings in Christianity that for me really hit at the heart of this. And there's one line in the book of Ephesians in chapter 4 where there's all this advice about life, right? And one of these lines is, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Now, that's a remarkably simple statement, don't let the sun go down on your anger.
Yeah, but profound.
But
hey?
Profound, because you think about the principle underlying that. And what's underlying it is, don't leave off today for tomorrow. So you can do something today rather than wait for tomorrow, because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And that for me is one of the powerful ideas of Christianity, is work on things, renewing of you and your relationships and your mind and how you act and in situations. Do that now, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. Strangeland is a cautionary tale about not just what can happen with your kids, but what can happen with your family and your relationships as well. So that's Strangeland, Mark. It's now showing at cinemas. Nicole Kidman is in it. I do recommend it. It just tapers off towards the end, but it is a powerful, haunting work about tragedy.
Okay, just be prepared to close your eyes when you get to the street scene. With
Nicole.
Well, look, that's Strangeland. And in fact, we actually have a bunch of things about Australia, if you like, and the outback coming up. One in particular, researcher Maya Hadley talks about the four categories of Australian film. If you ever struggle to actually understand where you fit in Australian film, or maybe even just pass a single conversation on Australian film, you'll be armed for that.
Struggle no more.
The answer's ahead. And we've even got some great stuff with Australian soundtracks coming up. But if you're particularly interested in Strangeland, there's a great article of this one by, it's by you.
What's that guy's name? Who wrote that, Mark? Who wrote that?
Ben McKeggan, actually, particular copy of Attorney, which you can pick up at your church if you're energetic enough to do it, or if you're basically just bone lazy, you can actually go to the Eternity website and look at the website there, and you'll find the article. And you'll find Ben detailing all the sorts of stuff he's only now wishing he'd remembered to say. it's an excellent article. Check out Eternity. In fact, there's lots of stuff in Eternity you probably want to check out. But now we're going to move on to something a little more interesting. We which is probably the worst lead-in from a previous thing.
I know, thank you. You were talking about something that I've written, Mark, that people should check out. No, really, go and check out the article. But that was boring. Let's go on to something far more exciting, which is what?
We actually managed to offend the sponsor and my co-host in one short sentence.
Yep.
Okay, not exactly what I meant. What I was actually going to talk about was a piece of music. You know, we're actually in soundtrack, and this is for those people who are not regulars of the show. Each week...
Why aren't you? And you should be, and yes, you will be now.
You will be. More hats will be available in the coming episodes. But look, each week we do a double segment called Soundtrack, in which we feature the other side of moving pictures, which is the sound that undergirds everything. And so this week we're going to look at some classic Outback-style Australian music. And this is... Now, be careful.
Oh, I see what you did there, because Strange Land set in the Outback, and now... Yeah, right.
You see, I was just... I had no new idea. So I went with the curve. Look, the thing here, I want to warn you, this is instrumental, so this is not tea time, okay? Listen to what the music does and see if you can't picture the scene of this particular song.
Outback?
Look, if you haven't actually clued in, this is the music from Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Oh, yeah, of course it is, yeah.
And so a 1975 film, Peter Weir, quite possibly...
Fantastic.
Yeah, benchmark Australian film. So, again, add it to your I should see this list before, I don't know, tomorrow. You know, something, I should see this film, because one of the things about it is just the whole evocative sense of the mystery of the Australian bush. Now, the storyline, for those of you who don't know, a few students and a teacher from an Australian school, a girls' school, vanish without trace on a picnic in a particular part of the Australian bush. And their absence frustrates and haunts the people left behind. Is it a murder? Is it something much more than that? Is it an alien abduction? Is it a schism in the spiritual world that somehow wandered into the dream time? You know, and this music kind of picks it up perfectly. It's actually panpipes. Now, I promised I would not try and say the traditional Romanian panpipe.
So why go against your promise, Mark?
I'm just
it
not
sounds like you're
do
going
it.
To.
You should Google it, okay? But Gheorghe Zamfir is the player, and he's sort of... What Peter Weir's done is he's matched this with a Swiss organ. It's kind of the weirdest contrast going on, this sort of muted sort of foreboding underneath with this sort of very delicate, strange sort of can't quite grasp melody on top.
Mm, which does capture beautifully what that movie's about.
The whole unknowable nature, the foreboding nature of Picnic at Hanging Rock. It is a brilliant piece. It's worth watching the film just to see how the music is integrated. And as Australians, we may be all bold and dismissive about the spiritual world, but the truth is Picnic at Hanging Rock's soundtrack hints at that disquiet that we feel whenever the spiritual seems to interact with our world. You know, and so I think it's a marvellous piece to consider.
Well, Mark, already on the show, we've talked about Julie Zemiro's Home Delivery, which many of those episodes are set in Australia, of people returning to where they're from.
And if they're not, the ones that really aren't should be.
And we've also talked about, at cinemas at the moment, Strangerland, this new Australian mystery thriller drama, which also is a lot to do with location, place, and home. We're at a regular segment of our show now called What the Bible's Got to Say. And every week, the Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator, Greg Clark, does what it says in the title. He helps us to understand what the Bible has to say about a particular topic. Now, in light of Home Delivery and Strangerland, we put to Greg, could you tell us what the Bible says about home?
Jesus said, "Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. That's from the Gospel of John, chapter 14, verse 23. Well, I'm a bit of a fan of the Australian poet Les Murray. Murray dedicates every volume of his poetry to the glory of God. And Christian themes are never far away from his thinking, whether it's about broad beans or politics or the complexities of family or the wondrous animal world. In one of his poems, called Home Sweet, he identifies that the quest that human beings are all on is to find their way home. Home is the first and final poem, he writes, and every poem between has this mum home seam. This lovely phrase, the mum home seam, sums up, I think, the Bible's view of what it means to come home. You could think of home as a place, and we do have all the language of heaven as our final resting place in the Bible, or a pasture where you lie down to relax beside streams of water. It's a very rural vision of home. But you also have the great city of God, where God dwells and we dwell with him, as our new home, the New Jerusalem, as described in the book of Revelation. These are all very physical images of home from the Bible. But more than that, the Bible describes home, true home, in terms of our relationships. Home is when you are safe in your mother or your father's arms, and that mother, that father, are completely safe people to be with, and what a wonderful dream that is for so many people. Home is when all your worries, all your fears, all your anxieties and insecurities can be laid aside. It's where you find life to its full, where love abounds, where the Father has come to make home with you, and nothing could be better.
Greg Clark from Bible Society Australia. Look, we've moved to that point of the show where we're going to be talking about our press record segment. This is where we hand the show over. We don't actually sort of try and do it ourselves. I mean, frankly, it's exhausting.
Puts the feet up on
it's
the chair.
It's exhausting being so entertaining.
Has a drink. Yeah. Oh, what don't I know?
Oh, mate. I don't know how you do it.
Actually, I don't either.
Yeah, in fact,
people listening
now that I think
don't
about
know.
It, yeah. Look, in a press record segment, we basically go out to you and ask maybe your opinions on your favourite films or things like that. Occasionally, we'll actually have just insights. And one of them this week is touching on the concept of home. You see, we've been doing it all through this week's program. And when it comes to film, that raises a touchy subject to me, you know, talking about home. Because, to be honest, I have struggled with our homemade films, you know, with Australian films for the longest times. I just didn't get Australian film, which is a huge admission.
As a rule?
Well, yeah.
Right.
I mean, there was a part of me that was just going, you know, you're so in love with film and you don't tend, you know, your love doesn't seem to extend to the things that are made here. Now, that's not everybody's experience, so just be fair about that. But I think also, you know, sometimes we look away and we don't really understand the stuff that's closest to us. And so I really struggled to try and understand Australian film until one day a film researcher I knew summarised the entire industry for me in four categories. She just went like, look, Australian film, this is all you need to know. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I went, wow, that is so brilliant. I've been passing it off as my own knowledge for ever since, you know. So, in fact, I came to respect her so much, I actually married her because it was cheaper than hiring her again and again for these productions.
Let's leave that alone and move forward with the segment.
That's right. You see, on press record this week, research and producer Maya Hadley, the great Maya Hadley, I like to refer to her as, gives us four simple points that will help you get a hold on any homegrown Australian film. So now you're back from
outer space. I just walked in to find- Be honest. Have you ever been embarrassed by Australian film? Maybe it was our kitschness or our Australian English. Maybe it was the way we dressed or the crassness of our humour. I mean, let's get skase, come on. I think I was embarrassed by Australian film for years, basically because I didn't understand Australian film. I felt like we were still experimenting, still finding our way along. I was sure that what I was watching from overseas had deeper storylines, more intricate plot developments and more profound insights into life. Why can't we do that? I used to think. It wasn't until I was in film studies at uni that I suddenly realised this. What I most cringed at in Australian film was what I eventually most identified with. Our sense of identity. Our films were telling me about who we were, who I was. My eyes were open, Taking a further step, I broke it down into four categories so I could understand it better, and I'm going to share them with you now. Number one, historical drama. I love these films. These are the films that teach us about our history, our mistakes, sure, but they also show us how we've struggled in the face of adversity. There's some great films in this category. To name just a few, we've got The Story of the Ned Kelly Gang, For the Term of His Natural Life, Breaker Morant, The Man from Snowy River, and one of my all-time favourites is the 1981 film Gallipoli. It's a stunning film directed by Peter Weir about two friends who faced the brutality of war during the Gallipoli campaign. It is heart-wrenching. It's a great film about mateship and endurance and loss. Our second category is our Indigenous voice. Our nation's Aboriginals tell us their story, their joys and hardships, their understanding of the land and its animals. There are so many great films in this category also. To name just a few again, we have Walkabout, Rabbit Proof Fence, Samson and Delilah, and the poetically beautiful Storm Boy, a 1977 film about a young boy who befriends a pelican and his friend Fingerbone Bill, who understands his love for this pelican and the ocean. Love is in the air, in the thunder of the sea. Kitsch comedy is our third category. This is a great category. It highlights our humour in the face of adversity, our dry wit, and often our irreverence. Also, our support for the underdog and acceptance of the immigrant, knowing that we ourselves are all immigrants, really. Some of the films in this category are The Castle, Strictly Ballroom, Crocodile Dundee, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and my favourite, 1994's Muriel's Wedding, about the ever-loving, socially awkward Muriel from Pauper Spit with her quirky, sad family and her journey of discovery as to who she is as a woman. That brings us to our last but not least category, and this one I like to call dark nihilistic drama. Now, I have to say, these are not my favourite kinds of films, but they do show the dark underbelly of our culture. They bring to light those who struggle, those who live on the fringe, those who feel they don't really belong, and that's why this category is equally compelling in understanding who we are. Films in this category are films like Romper Stomper, The Boys, Black Rock, Wolf Creek, and the Heath Ledger classic Two Hands, about a young 19-year-old boy scraping by as a promoter for a strip club at King's Cross, who has the opportunity to make it big and impress a crime boss when everything goes tragically wrong. So there you have it. Historical drama, Indigenous voice, kitsch comedy and dark nihilistic drama. Four categories, four things to ponder about who we are, what makes us laugh, what makes us cry, and what makes us understand ourselves a little bit better.
Isn't she marvellous? And now Ben.
They are.
Actually, I was going to say... Really, thanks to we hope to get a few more people like that. You know, people who've sort of got their fingers in the industry and who can actually sort of expand our understanding. And hopefully, you can just listen to the show rather than marry them to actually get their sort of wisdom.
You don't have to marry us to be on this show.
You don't have to,
but it sure helps.
Well, at the moment, it's not really an option. I don't know where I'm going with that. Leave that alone. Look, the next segment for us is top five. And I just want to say I'm so looking forward to this segment. This is Make a Stand Films. So this is actually dedicated to Consuela, our camera person who actually has to stand every episode.
Yeah, so, always making a stand. That's the reason we picked top five Make a Stand movies, Mark. You're right, because of Consuela, our camera woman who always is always standing during these shoots.
The most attractive and talented Spanish camera woman in Australia.
Before we get...
Unless she's a man. I'm not quite sure.
We'll leave Consuelo alone. Before we get to the list, I just wanted to point out, because although I'm sure people have been noticing this at home, I know you've been noticing this, Mark, that one of the great things about having your own podcast is you get to make up the rules of the podcast. And,
yes.
And among the rules of the podcast is we do a top five list. That's great. And what I've been doing is I like to narrow down the parameters of my list because otherwise it can just get a bit out of control. So... And when I go into my Make a Stand list, what I won't be talking about are documentaries, for one, because on next week's show, listen out for this, Mark is going to do top five documentaries. So I'm not touching documentaries.
People, this is the rant you've been waiting for.
That's next week. So no documentaries. And also, I'm not doing any Make a Stand movies based on real life individuals. So I'm not doing, so Gandhi's not on this list. Schindler's List isn't on this list. Hotel Rwanda's not on this list. Aaron Brockovich isn't on this list.
Rubbish, all of them.
But what is on the top five Make a Stand list are is?
Five.
Are is. I'm glad Maya went through that potted description of what Australian films are like, because that number five is The Castle. The Castle is a great
comedy.
Make a Stand movie. I think it's a little bit like, this might make it sound a bit grand, but it's like It's a Wonderful Life, that great Frank Capra, James Stewart movie from eons ago about the small guy who's standing up against a big corporation. It's basically... little guy versus the country or the government or corporations or whatever it might be. And that's what The Castle beautifully and very funnily captures.
I love that. That's a brilliant comparison.
Thank you very much. I think I'm the first person to ever describe It's a Wonderful Life and The Castle in the same sentence, but it's on record.
No,
that's great.
It's as far as, it's a classic as far as Australians concerned.
It's about the vibe. So I just like the character of Daryl Kerrigan, who's going up against the government who are trying to compulsorily acquire his house. It's a really quite remarkable story about a guy who just decides, I'm not going to sit here and take it. I'm going to do something about it. That's number five.
Four.
Go back to the bit at the start where I said where we make up our own rules. I'm actually going to break them now.
And now?
There is one movie on this list that is based on real events, but it's not about one particular individual. It's about one situation. So I picked this excellent film called The Battle of Algiers, which is from the early 60s. It's black and white. It's set in Algeria, and it's about French colonial occupying forces against guerrilla fighters who are trying to liberate Algerians from the French.
I wish I had a bell at this point, just a ring. It's almost like we need a sound effect to say, black and white film has arrived, referred to by Ben.
Uh-huh. It's that time of the show where we get to that. The reason I picked it, not just because it's an amazing piece of work and people should go and check it out. This thing revolutionized cinema. It's a documentary-style film shot on location and an amazingly powerful portrait. Why I picked it for Make a Stand movies is because most Make a Stand movies only depict one side standing against another. Battle of Algiers tries to present both sides at the same time making a stand against each other. And as one review I read of this said, it's scrupulously balanced in its presentation of making a stand. That's why I chose Battle of Algiers at number four.
Three.
Do the Right Thing is at number three. Have you seen that, Mark? Do the Right Thing?
Yeah, of course. It's a brilliant film.
Fantastic piece of work. The reason it's on this list is because most of the examples I'm picking on here, most of the examples you would think of when you make a stand, they're usually positive. Even if the situation's obviously usually negative, that someone's rising up against oppression or whatever it might be. Do the Right Thing, though, is an amazing cautionary tale from the 80s, this really kind of hip-hop-infused melting pot movie set in New York. But it's a cautionary tale about what you take a stand on. And the catalyst in this film for some incredible heart-wrenching events is a guy wanting to boycott a pizzeria in Brooklyn in New York because the owner of the pizzeria, who's Italian-American, doesn't have up on his wall pictures of African-Americans. So there are these... Yeah. What happens as a result of taking a stand based on photographs on a wall becomes this incredible combustible situation of racial and kind of social intolerance. But Do the Right Thing on this Make a Stand list is here because I think it's a big warning to us about what it is we actually... where we pick our battles. It's about where we pick our battles. So that's Do the Right Thing at number three.
Two.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Ah.
Thank you very much.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
There we go.
Surely.
It makes me wonder what's going to be number one, because this is a fantastic film.
Yeah, surely.
You must have really
Most people, if they haven't seen it, already know what this is, that incredible Jack Nicholson film from the 70s. It also is based on true ish events but not on a particular one individual, but this movie about a man who is in a mental institution, and he fighting the power inside there is this representation of anyone who's a little bit out of the ordinary, a little bit not quite keeping with mainstream society, and what mainstream society can do to try to ram someone back into that mold.
Into the mold, yeah.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is an excellent portrait of someone saying, like, no, and with good reason, and it's a strong critique against the system and people trying to, you know, just basically squeeze people into that mainstream box. It's a very good critique of the power, the force of oppression, and then people trying to fight back against that. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
One. Which is it? Back out ready now. Come on. Okay, make it.
So far, I've ticked off two I haven't seen and two I have, and I'm ready. What is it?
Number one, make a stand movie, 12 Angry Men from 1957.
And I would watch that again in a heartbeat.
12 Angry Men. For anyone who hasn't seen this, go and see it. Like, stop. Hit pause now and go and find this movie. Great piece of work. It's got Henry Fonda starring as one of 12 jurors, and so these 12 angry men, jurors. The whole film is set in the back room of a courthouse, and these men are deliberating on a murder case. Henry Fonda is the one guy on the jury who believes there's reasonable doubt. And so everyone on the jury wants him to, like, just say the guy's guilty so we can go home and get out of this sweltering courtroom room that they're in, and the tension rises.
Which is literal too, because, like, there's no heat in the room.
Yeah.
So it's both physically a pressure cooker and, you know, and also emotionally it's a pressure cooker, as they're going from this position of no one believes, or almost no one believes, this guy could be innocent. And the turning of the tire is incredible.
Yeah. So I picked this one because I think this is a great presentation of a guy doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. He's like, he's one good man in the right place at the right time. And no matter the weight of the opposing view against you, the fact that he is in such the minority, and the easier course for him to take would be just to say, all right, then we'll just vote this guy guilty. But he doesn't. And he stands up against everybody else on the jury and takes that stand. So I think 12 Angry Men, 1957, is a fantastic demonstration of, like an idea I think that's captured very well in the Bible. In James 4, it talks about it's sinful for someone to know what is good to do but not to do it. And I think 12 Angry Men captures that beautifully, and that's why it's at number one on the Make a Stand list.
Here's what I think happened.
How can you be positive about anything?
I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing.
You are going to try a man for murder. The awesome power to kill will suddenly be thrust into your hands.
Watch them and pray, for someday you may become one of them.
I've got to say, this is such a... look. Caps off. If I had one, which
if
I don't
you were
wear,
wearing a beanie in the studio like I am, Matt, studio, you would Mark, you would take it off to me.
I would. In fact, I'd give it to you at this point.
I'll take it off to myself.
12 Angry
Men. 12 Angry Men. Well chosen.
Oh, gosh. Now people are just going,
put it back
wow,
on.
He's got no hair. Look, 12 Angry Men, for those people who are maybe on the edge, go and see it, because this is technically one of the most brilliant films sort of ever written/shot. You know, it is a single location. It is black and white. It is 12 men talking at each other with minimal cutting, and you think to yourself, I cannot think of a description that would make that harder to watch, and yet it is just is
tense, engrossing viewing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Well done.
Okay, how are you going to top that?
Well, I'm going to take us away from the pictures and onto the sound again. We're back to a soundtrack. It's the second part of our segment in which we look at the sound that undergirds. Now, we've been talking on and off this week about Australian film, and so I've got a second Australian soundtrack for you. Now, there are a lot of songs that are famous in their own right from this particular film that I'm going to sort of like showcase in a second. In particular, Jessica's theme. Now, that might give it away for some people. Or the main theme itself is just so instantly recognisable as Australian, so much so that it was incorporated into the opening ceremony of the Sydney 2000 Olympics. Of course, I'm talking about The Man from Snowy River. But the track I'm going to play you this week is not the one you think. It's also from the film. It's just as significant, though, but because of the way its composer, Bruce Rowland, has managed to use instruments to characterise the elements of the Australian bush.
Thank you.
Bruce Rowland composed the music for the film and also conducted the orchestra during the recording of the album, and it encapsulates the majestic beauty of the snowy mountains on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. It's got the wild Brumbies and the rough, powerful beauty of the landscape. And if you listen carefully, you can actually hear music being used in a way that builds the visuals that you might not even be seeing. You can hear oboes used to convey the sweeping crags, the snowy mountains, violins for sunlight breaking over the ridges, bassoons for the wild birds, and of course the rolling kettle drums and French horns, you know, later in the track for the charging Brumbies. For me, it is one of the high points of the soundtrack art, when a simple sound can evoke so many feelings and pictures. You know, it's almost godlike. Like when God uses simple words to create an entire world, or when the Word becomes flesh and appears as Jesus Christ, you've got a sound just bringing everything into reality. And that's soundtrack for this week.
That part of the show where we're talking about what the kids are watching this
week. Those kids. Yeah. What are they up there doing today?
And this is going to be a huge segment this week because we're talking about a huge movie, and it's so huge we had to increase our segment size by one person. So the awesome Sam Robinson is here from Hope's Sunday morning program. Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
And it's not just because you're talented, it's because you're young. Okay. We've just expanded the entire market of the show.
I'm younger. I'm older than I look.
Come on, mate. Just go to the young bit.
Okay,
go to the young bit.
Seriously.
Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. But it's been 22 years since Jurassic Park was out. Been 14 years since the third Jurassic Park movie. And if anyone doesn't know the storyline of Jurassic Park and now Jurassic World, you're going to real soon because it's going to dominate our screens everywhere. But it's basically more computer-generated dinosaurs rampaging on screen because it turns out that when they're in a theme park with other people, it doesn't tend to go that well.
You just went and made a new dinosaur?
Yeah, it's kind of what we do here. The exhibit opens to the public in 3 weeks. Mr. Mizrani wanted me to consult with you.
You want to consult here or in my bungalow?
That's not funny.
A little funny.
We'd like you to evaluate the paddock for vulnerabilities.
Why me?
I guess Mr. Mizrani thinks since you're able to control the raptors.
See, it's all about control with you. I don't control the raptors. It's a relationship. It's based on mutual respect.
Because this segment is so massive this week about Jurassic World, and it's so expanded because Sam's joining us, we had to put more microphones in here. And for anyone watching the video, hi to you at home. That's why this microphone is up here in front of my face, unlike other weeks. Mark.
Well, look, like the first film, very much like the first film, you know, geneticists are at it again in Lost World. And though instead of being happy with cloning
Jurassic World,
just in case they can't get enough fun out of cloning dinosaurs, they've decided to basically mutate dinosaurs this time, do a mix and match game and bring together some of the most irksome and fearsome characteristics so they can raise the sort of falling profits of the park.
But what could possibly go wrong?
That's basically what Chris Pratt, you know, recently Star-Lord, now Owen Grady, plays the role of the fun but sensible animal handler who sounds the note of caution, you did what? You know, and then you've got the also doubling as the Jeff Goldblum character. They've sort of merged them into two where he says you really should be respecting nature a lot more. Maybe you caught that bit about the respect and the relationship at the end. And so, surprise, when everything goes to hell in a genetically monstrified Indominus Rex handbasket, it's basically him running for the helicopters and dragging us along with him. But, you know, maybe you haven't seen that plot before.
Because you haven't seen any Jurassic Park movies before. Sam, are you pumped about seeing this? I kind of am, sort of am. What about you?
I'm kind of, sort of as well, I think, because, you know, I don't know if they can recreate the magic of Jurassic Park.
So this movie's had a big impact on you as a kid?
Yes and no. I was 6 years old when the first one came out.
So it had a huge impact. In fact, you're terrified for nights.
Well, no, I wasn't. I didn't actually see it in the movies. I think my parents are pretty wise in not taking me. But I did on TV a few years later, and I loved dinosaurs as a kid. So it really does capture your imagination. I think what I've noticed in years since is that there's always a child character in the film. And I think that's what you can relate to as a kid, you know. You're growing up and so the adults are on this adventure, but there's always a kid along for the ride as well.
Do you think there's always that sort of, they use that character to do the reveal. You may think dinosaurs are fun, but this one has teeth.
I know. Yeah, so. And the T-Rex, you know, that scene, the T-Rex through the top of the Jeep. You know, that's just awesome. Such an amazing scene you know, the kids are terrified and I don't know.
Little children being
the concept, particularly the first one, was fantastic and the execution of it for, 22 years ago was incredible. But does the world need another dinosaur theme park goes crazy, people have to run away from them movie?
I don't know. We all know it's going to be the same plot again, obviously.
In case what Mark's description of it didn't give that away.
Exactly. I mean, Chris Pratt's in this, and I love Chris Pratt in Parks and Rec, and also in as Star-Lord.
It's amazing he's become the action hero he's starting to become, and he seems like a really good choice for it. Like, he's great in Parks and Recreation as the comedy funny guy. Very unexpected, I think, where he's going, but he seems to fit in quite nicely.
That's right. And I'm also keen to see how much of the, in the first film they had the animatronics and I think that really made it, but are they going all CGI in this? I don't know. The trailer would suggest that's the way and I think it loses a bit of the magic that
way. It's interesting because what you're referring to largely is the first film and everyone forgets that there was Jurassic Park, you know, Lost World 2 and Jurassic Park 3 that came in between, which really sort of took the franchise to the dogs. You know, is it a rebirth or is it more of the same?
I don't know. I can't really remember much about the third, but I saw The Lost World. I saw the second one this week, and I was bored for most of it, except there was that scene at the end where the dinosaur ends up in San Diego.
I don't know, King Kong.
So. I know, exactly.
Where they bring the ape to New York, yeah.
Godzilla, and that's exactly what they're trying to recreate, but it just got silly. So I hope that this new one won't be like that.
Can we learn anything about our limitations, you know, our arrogance from films like this? Is that really what they're built on? That, you know, hey, remember your place, humanity, you just happen to be this big as opposed to other things?
I think so.
Yeah, the first one was really good about the best and worst of human endeavour. You're expecting that's going to happen here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the first one is like, man, they were able to make dinosaurs scientifically. And now this time it's like, the T-Rex is bad, but let's make a new dinosaur.
Let's make a bad one. And what could happen?
Here's an idea.
Yeah. Mistakes are made it again and again. And it's great for us to watch in the cinema because we're so distant from it. But I think it's a real reflection on, you know, just our rebellion against a god and trying to be god.
Can I just point out at this point that if they'd read their own script, they would have realised this was all going to go bad? I mean, Indominus Rex, was that ever going to be cuddly?
But what kind of a movie would it be if you just see, you know, no mayhem at all? That's what we want to see, right?
But that is true. You know it's going to come and we can be as kind of snippy and snide about that as we want. But you're right. Deep down, we do want the mayhem. That is a reason you're going to see these movies.
Why do we expect that things are going to go wrong when we play God?
Oh, because it's not the way it's meant to be, is it? It's rejection, it's rebellion, it's us thinking that we're the boss,
Even necessarily a Christian thing. That's the weird thing. This is not made by some Christian production company out of the Midwest. You know, this is basically a secular film down the line saying when we take on godlike powers, we'd better watch out because, let's face it, people, we're not.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And you see it again and again in movies. I mean, you know, Tomorrowland, we're the way of fixing everything. You know, it's not true at all.
No.
And this is our what the kids are watching segment for this week. And the kids, the young people, the families are definitely going to be trooping out for this. I'm not sure what it's rated, but I presume it's probably going to come in an M rating. So loads of people are going to be going on to see this. For families out there that might be concerned, let's say Christian families that might be concerned about subject matter, dinosaurs, and they might be a little bit freaked out about, the Bible doesn't seem to talk about dinosaurs. Were dinosaurs real? Should they be terrified about a movie like this? Should they be concerned about what it could be suggesting about dinosaurs in the Bible?
That's a big question, Ben.
It is. Thank you. It's a very Sam, big question. Answer it, Sam.
I love that you get the guest to answer this one. Yeah. Oh, look, I think, you know, the Bible, I'm not across creationism and all that kind of stuff as much as other people would be. And I think that, you know, the Bible does say that the world was created. Things were created. Things were good when God created them. Whether God created dinosaurs or dinosaur bones or whatever, we know that, in creation, God was good. He made good things. And creation really reveals his character and his imagination.
Yeah, mate, you're right. And the Bible doesn't profess to be a scientific textbook, for one. It doesn't attempt to catalogue every single thing that ever happened on the face of the planet ever, including whether dinosaurs did or did not exist. And that doesn't seem to be the issue that the Bible's trying to present. I'm with you. What I think God's word is presenting about God is who God is, what God's about, that he was the creator, and the way he set his world in place and how he would like it to run, and the order he's looking for in that, as opposed to the chaos that can ensue in the Jurassic Park franchise when you try to play God.
Yeah, I was going to say, even though this is a secular film, as we've already said, you actually see the reflections of God's character in the film. Because basically, when you look at the dinosaurs that have just been brought back as is, as they should be, so like genetically speaking, as they were designed to be, if you like, they're actually working in harmony with each other. You know, the Chris Pratt character is dealing with the velociraptors, but they're not unreasoning beasts. They've got rules and ways that they behave. It's when we throw stuff together in a way it was never meant to work, that's when it all goes crazy, if you ignore the first three films.
So, Sam, final words on Jurassic World. Are you still, after this conversation, somewhat looking forward to this?
I am, in a way. I don't have high hopes for this movie.
But
really,
bring on the mayhem.
It's going to sell a lot of tickets. It's going to sell a lot of merchandise. Kids are going to go crazy for it. And, you know, it's been a long time. So people who were kids who are now adults are going to see it again as well. So I think, yeah, it's going to be a hit.
Mate, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Well, that's what kids are watching this week. Ben, what are you finding out on the screen for us?
Mate, there's a fair bit around. So apart from Jurassic World dominating screens around the place, there's this new comedy with Reese Witherspoon and Modern Family Sofia Vergara called Hot Pursuit, which, judging by reviews out of the States, isn't much chop.
Sounds B-grade.
It's like one of those buddy cop, odd couple movies. So Reese Witherspoon is like the straight-laced cop, and she's taking Sofia Vergara's character, who's the wife of a drug dealer, across the country because she has to do some kind of testifying in court, that kind of thing. Hilarity allegedly is meant to ensue, but by all reports, it doesn't tend to.
So this time she's not the lawyer, aka Legally Blonde 2, but she's now
she's the person
taking us to the
lawyer. Yeah, and I won't be rushing out to see it. Also around the place, some smaller films. I think among them, probably the most one, the biggest one of note, is The Emperor's New Clothes, which is this. It's a documentary that great English filmmaker called
Michael. You made a promise about not mentioning documentaries. That's next week's show, people.
I'm going to mention it really quickly because it is in cinemas. It's directed by this great English guy called Michael Winterbottom, who's made a whole host of really different movies. Among them now, Emperor's New Clothes, which is Russell Brand, the comedian, fronting a documentary about the inequality of wealth distribution around the planet.
Now, why do I feel uneasy about that combination?
One of the best things about it is that it's got loads of facts and figures that are quite damning and condemning, particularly post-GFC, about just how the world operates and the way the rich seem to have everything and the poor still continue to be poor and it gets bigger. And it's really quite alarming. The downside is that the messenger, Russell Brand, who's a comedian, if you don't know the guy, you would have seen him in different things. He kind of spoils it. Like, he's almost shooting himself in the foot because it's very difficult to take this guy seriously, even when he's being serious.
And he also happens to be one of the richest comedians in the world.
Which he doesn't really address in this documentary. It's like the massive elephant in the room. Dude, you are rich. And the only time he mentions it is right at the end, and he makes a joke out of it. And that, for me, kind of like let a lot of the air out
of
that balloon.
Yeah, you want to say, did you at least donate your fee?
But that,
what are you doing?
But if you want to know more about what I think on that kind of movie, go to the latest edition of Empire magazine, because I reviewed Strangerland, I reviewed The Emperor's New Clothes, I reviewed The Mafia Only Kills in Summer, which is also out at some cinemas around the place. I own June 11. I own June 11 and Empire. Go and read what I think.
Ben McKechnie, workaholic. Out there for you at the cinemas.
That's the cinemas. And I'll quickly just mention a handful of movies that are out on DVD and Blu-ray. There's one called The Boy Next Door. Jennifer Lopez is in. Looks terrible. It looks like an attempted remake at Fatal Attraction, but she's having an affair with a 17-year-old boy. Looks shocking. It's got like 10% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'd be saying avoid that. There's The Interview, which made such a stink last year, that James Franco, Seth Rogen movie where they went to North Korea to kill the leader of North Korea. The movie itself is a little bit of a disappointment considering all the controversy that went on around it. It really feels like a one idea that was very shocking and very confronting, and I'm not even sure they should have bothered doing it. But when they get there, they can't seem to make the joke last as long as they possibly can. They have a few shots at like America kind of trying trying to police the world, but then they sort of fall a bit short as well. So it's not as amazing or confronting as what you might think.
It is actually confronting in terms of the humour. Be careful, because there's a lot of jokes in this film that you want to be...
True, yeah. Very crass and very, like, wow, like, that's a lot of strong language.
If you're thinking, oh, wow, I might see that controversial film, it's going to be controversial for a couple of other reasons too, so just be cautious.
And this year's Best Picture winner, Birdman, is out on DVD. I didn't see it. I'm really keen to see it. I know you saw it and didn't think much of it.
Oh, look, I think it's a good film. I think it's a good film. It's just really hard when people hand the highest, you know, sort of award in terms of sort of cinematic industry, Best Picture, to a film... that's in the company of a lot of other films that might have deserved it more. So, you know.
So, what will you be looking at this week?
Well, small screen actually has some interesting stuff to look at this week. So, I just want to say, basically, guys, you know, if you're not entranced by anything being said about the cinemas, though, do get Empire Magazine. That's great. Read all about it. I think you can actually spend some valuable time on the TV, so long as you avoid Channel 9 at Mondays at 8:30 p.m. because we missed the start of, we missed the start of Married at First Sight, which is that sort of Danish format about taking...
It's become huge, though, hasn't
random
it?
Australians. Yeah, this is like watching car crash television. You know, it's you know it's not going to go well when you take some random Australians.
But we
together.
Can't take our eyes off it.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I feel like there's been enough to devalue marriage in Australian society as it is. I'm not a big fan of people sort of trying to support this. Remember, people, you actually have a vote. You know, not turning on actually does help. So, you know, I don't know.
What should we watch?
Well, instead, what you should do is you go to the ABC on this Tuesday, so tomorrow night, and you'll see the ABC's three-part special, The Killing Season. This is Sarah Ferguson's gripping three-part examination of the forces that shaped Labor during the Kevin Rudd, you know, Julia Gillard leadership years. So basically, it's a no-holds-barred approach to what happened. You know, I mean, we lived through an amazing stage in which we started to realise that in Australian politics where the leader of the country could be axed by his own party and kicked out. Now, we've had that before, but in the most surreptitious and strange way ever, and parties could go on pretending like they hadn't done anything wrong. You know, so it's kind of really interesting to watch this all unfold in a really neat and enthralling way. And June 10 on DVD... The Mad Max trilogy is out.
Oh, yeah, okay. Of course.
They're re-releasing it on Blu-ray and DVD. I've actually been holding off for this, you know, because I didn't want the DVD copies, to be honest. You know, I wanted to see the Blu-ray. I wanted to see all its magnificence. I wanted to see Tina Turner sing again in Thunderdome.
I didn't. I'm more hanging out for the second one, the sequel.
The sequel. So I sort of think that this is really worth, you know, dragging out. We'll actually have some more on Mad Max in coming shows. We're actually going to have the mum of the original Mad Max character actually come on the show and chat to us about that. She's a Christian. She's got some great things to say. But look, also this week, on Sunday, I've touched on this series before. Compass is doing a series called Whatever Happened To, and this coming Sunday they do Whatever Happened To Marriage Guidance. It's a great question.
In complete contrast to that other show, Married at First Sight.
I think it's a companion piece to Married at First Sight. What they have instead is Whatever Happened To Marriage Guidance. Why did we stop thinking about getting married? You know, how did it become a reaction rather than something we should actually be thinking through? Okay, and then also, you've got June 14, the ABC launches one of its biggest drama productions for the year. This is incredible stuff, well worth tuning in on, and it's only on two nights, people. So this is The Secret River. It's the drama series based on colonial life around the Hawkesbury.
It's based on that Kate Grenville novel?
Yeah, that's right.
Super successful.
Multi-award-winning novel. It's going to be one of those things, you know, I suspect will be benchmark Australian television. So if you like Australiana, if you like Australian drama, you really should be on the ABC on this coming Sunday.
Mm, so that's what's around this week. But coming up on next week's program, Mark, on
have
the Big
we
Picture.
Alluded to it? Have we said anything about it?
Mate, we have a little bit, but just put it out there. We're going to be keeping it real. We're going to be focusing on the Stephen Hawking movie, The Theory of Everything, about Stephen Hawking's life. You're going to get into your top five best documentaries ever of all time, all that kind of thing.
We're going to go documentary crazy next week.
And then we're also going to talk about Minions.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
I've been Ben McKechnie.
I'm still Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 1032's family of podcasts and vodcasts.